Now, tonight's an introduction to the video series, How Should We Then Live? And I want to take a little bit of time to introduce that before we actually started the video itself. And tell Bob, you know, I'm going to need him in here early next week and show me how to set this up so that we can get it on the speakers. Okay? And so it's important. I think Mr. Eisnagel and I are going to talk in the morning, but I think maybe the high school and junior high age will join us. I think it might be really good to have our younger ones exit for there's some stuff in there that's just they're not quite appropriate for them. For one thing, we're looking. It's one of the things you do is you look at the art. The art's always a reflection of a civilization, and so those of you who've been to Europe have an idea that some of the art just isn't appropriate for, well, anybody, but, you know, younger kids especially can't handle that. So, of course, probably nothing different than anybody sees on TV anyway. So, I mean, we've come so far in this country that, what was it? There's that line out of Sleepless in Seattle, I think, where the dad says to the kid, where have you been watching that? You're not supposed to know that stuff. And he said, well, my good friend has cable, you know. And the basic point is that probably our kids have seen just about everything anyway. Which commentary, all by itself, Isaiah chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. He said, "Let me sing now for my well beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around." Removed its stones, planted it with the choicest vine, built a tower in the middle of it, and hewed out a wine vat in it, then expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. Now, you can tell Jesus is a student of Scripture. For one thing, this is really a parallel to the parable he told about the guy who planted a vineyard, built a wall around it, dug a wine press, and rented it out to vine growers. Okay. Here the picture is slightly different in that he expected it to produce good grapes. Now, specifically, what he's talking about is the nation Israel. And we're going to use the nation Israel tonight as a means by which we introduce a series on how should we then live. All societies have kind of an ebb and a flow. There's channels they go down. There's directions they go. There's tendencies that they have. And if you don't pay attention to those, you're going to get caught. George Santayana, well-known philosopher, made the statement, "Those who will learn nothing from history are destined to repeat it." And so what we're going to see is first with Israel tonight in kind of rapid-fire terms, and then when we start the video series, we're going to begin with Rome. Now, the video series is dealing specifically with what's called Western civilization. Western civilization is that which grew out of Greece and Rome, but which was profoundly impacted by the Bible. At first, the Greeks weren't. At first, the Romans weren't. But particularly, at some point, Western civilization ended up being built on the principles of the Bible. And to have seen that develop and then to see what happens to it is highly significant and worthy of our attention and consideration. Now, Israel itself went through a similar cycle. And Israel, of course, began as a nation when God brought Israel out of Egypt with a mighty outstretched hand and an uplifted arm and under the earthly leadership of Moses himself. It continued, and first it was a republic, and then at some point the moral level of the republic declined so much that it step by step devolved into tyranny. The nation split at the death of Solomon. And as you recall, Solomon's son Rehoboam, when he became king, all the nation of Israel met to ask him what sort of policies he was going to have. And he said, my father, what he did was he laid a little finger on you. He said, I'm going to lay something as thick as loins on you. He said, my father beat you with whips. He said, I'm going to beat you with scorpions, or actually loaded scourges. In other words, anything Solomon did, Rehoboam says he was going to crank it up. See, it was tyranny. So 10 of the 12 tribes revolted and became the nation Israel. The other two, basically Judah and Benjamin, took the name or retained the name Judah in the capital, Jerusalem. Isaiah here is kind of looking at the nation as a whole, Israel as a whole, and how God started out. He said, I planted it. And he said, I expected it to produce some good grapes. Instead of producing good grapes, it only produced worthless ones. Now, morality is a major issue. There is no nation that can survive very long on an immoral basis without descending into totalitarianism. That's why would-be totalitarians always work on the destruction of morality ahead of their imposition of tyranny. Israel went through that. Now, part of it is just almost a natural law. In other words, God doesn't necessarily have to do anything specifically. When societies decide to take certain choices, certain natural laws of cause and effect are there. What God calls, what you sow is what you reap. And so societies decline once they choose the route of rejection of authority, once they choose the route of overthrowing a belief in God and God's principles. Israel, of course, is the great example. We have its history chronicled. Now, one of the things that the Bible does is it paints you a picture of the rise of these civilizations, and it paints you a picture of their fall. Remember what God told Israel as they prepared to take the promised land? He said, it's not that you guys are so good that I'm going to give you the land of Canaan. He said that the Amorites that are on the land are so bad that the land's throwing them out. So he said, don't get any big ideas about yourself. There's just certain natural laws that God has in there. And if a nation allows the land to be polluted by the blood of the innocent, then the land itself eventually will spew it out. Ultimately, it's the picture of the entire earth. There is a covenant of salt that's in effect, and that's why Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth. As the salt of the earth, we're the only reason that the sacrifice of the earth itself is eventually acceptable to God. So in verse 3 of Isaiah 5, he said, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I had not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? I did everything I could. Now, if God says he did everything he could, everything that could have been done was done. That tells you a lot about the human heart. It tells you a lot about the rebellious nature of man. It gives you an idea of man's ability to twist things around so that they're just going to do what they good and well please anyway. And justify it and say God is in favor of it. That's kind of one of the great themes of the prophets, you know. So God says, so let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'm going to remove its hedge and it will be consumed. I'll break down its wall. It'll become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up, and I'll also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. All right? If you guys are supposed to produce grapes and you're good fruit and you're not, then this is what we're going to do. We're going to tear her down. For the vineyard, he says in verse 7, is the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. And for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. One of the things that runs as a continual theme through God's Word is justice. It says over and over again, he looks for justice. He expects there to be justice. Now, what is it that defines justice? Well, it's God's law that defines justice. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. If you steal something, you got to return what you stole plus one-fifth extra. You don't pay a fine to the government. You actually return what you stole to the person you stole it from plus a fifth extra. You know, if there's any problem with your ox, then you pay the person who's injured. That was part of the justice system. Now, our system is just totally broke down in the realm of justice. Time after time after time, people can actually get judgments from the courts, but they can't collect them. I was involved in a situation recently where the court said to this individual that you're going to pay, and they said, no, we're not, and you can't make us. See ya. It was a state Supreme Court, one of the states in the union. See, that's where we're at. The judges and the justices, so-called, who sit on the bench, they're not interested in justice. It's a political agenda. And the judgments are issued on the basis of what's going to further a political agenda, depending on the viewpoint of the judge. When the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals can sit in San Francisco and say that the Second Amendment does not grant the private citizen the right to keep and bear arms, then you got a pretty good idea that justice is a long ways away. See, that there's words don't have meaning. Everything is up to an arbitrary decision of a judge. And when it becomes arbitrary, there's no justice. Do you think you can count on the whims of somebody, their emotional feeling for the day? Do you think you can count on that? A number of years ago, there was a girl named Pam Alford lived with us. And Pam Hansen Alford's her name now. Or Pam Alford Hansen was her name then. Pam Hansen Alford now. She's an insurance salesman in Great Falls. But she was a coach and a PE teacher at Belgrade. And the issue was that PE, the girls were supposed to shower after they had their PE class. Okay, that was the rules. And so one of the girls said she wasn't going to take a shower. So Pam had to act. Well, then eventually went to the district judge. And I went to sit on the trial. And it was really interesting because the girl had psoriasis. And the claim was that if she showered, it would make the psoriasis worse, right? Now, I think that's not exactly the way that works, see? And so, you know, it was like an hour and a half, 2 hour trial, you know, presentations were made. When it was done, the judge said that he'd been a longtime friend of the family. This is his last case. It's like December 28th. He's retiring on January 1st. And so the girl didn't have to take a shower. And he was out of there. Bang the gavel, he was gone. Oh, yes, he said that in court. I mean, at least my ears heard that, Stan. I mean, there wasn't any attempt at justice at all. I mean, I don't know what the correct decision would have been. My natural tendency would say, you know, make her take a shower if that's the rules, but. You know, may have been more complicated than that. But the point is, the judge didn't even try. He said he's a friend of the family. I mean, should have recused himself in the first place if he's a friend of the family. But no justice. Now, if the people have an idea that there's at least going to be some semblance of justice, that they might have a shot at a fair trial, you know, and that's what the Constitution talks about. For example, swift and sure justice is one of the things that comes to us. But the idea is that you, when in an American court, see, there's enough things that they put in there that, let's say you're the defendant. Okay, you have all the same rights as a defendant as the prosecutors have. In other words, you have the right to subpoena witnesses. And in other words, when you subpoena the witnesses have to be there. In other words, the court is going to back, you know, your defense side with the same rules that the prosecuting side has. That's part of the idea that you're going to have in order to get justice. In a criminal case, you can have a jury trial, and you have to be convicted by all jurors. All jurors have to agree that you're guilty. See, the idea was to make sure that you got a fair trial. Those are things that they tried to set up in this country. One of the things that's happened is the jurors don't know what the responsibility of a jury is. Every court case I've ever been in on where the jury's there, the judge will say something like this. He said, "Now, it's not your job as the jury to determine whether this is a just law. It's only your job to determine whether a person is innocent or guilty based on the law that you've been given." Now, they don't use exactly those words, but that's real close to what they say. The first responsibility of a jury is to determine whether the law is constitutional or not. That's the very first responsibility that a jury has. See, in the courts today, they say that's not the responsibility of the jury. See, and that's how a lot of things in the Constitution get overthrown. It's because the juries are ignorant. So, justice is one of those things that disappears. How much justice do you think you get in Russia, for example, under that enlightened and westward-looking individual, Vladimir Putin? You know, it's kind of interesting. This guy that was poisoned, he was in England, and he was poisoned after, he was eating lunch with some people from Russia, and after that he started dying of being poisoned. Levitenko, I think, was his name. Well, he had documentation. He was a defector, basically. He had documentation, which he had made provisions to make sure it got published in case something happened to him, and it did happen to him. He had documentation that Russia was actually the one organizing and financing the Muslim terrorist organizations. Okay. So he had to die. You understand? That's not politically correct. And of course, that's been pretty well known to anybody that's a little bit of a student of that anyway. But his information was, and he was trying to bring that public, make that well known. If you know how these things operate, do you think the guy from Iran, who do you think's backing him? See, who do you think supplies Iran with the weapons that they supply the terrorists that are in Iraq with right now? You just follow a few trails. How much justice do you think you get in a Russian court? If the FSB, which is their new name for the secret police, if they come and get you, what do you think? That's humankind. That's what happened to Israel. God looked for justice, there wasn't any. And he looked for righteousness, there wasn't any. When we get a chance to look at some of these videos, we're going to see how low, say, for example, Roman society sunk and why it collapsed. Because, the decadence and the lack of righteousness. The things will make you sit up and take notice, particularly if you pay attention to your own society. God is interested in righteousness. God is. You know, when the Bible says about Jesus, the scepter of righteousness, the righteous scepter, is in his right hand. See, that's the standard of his rule, is righteousness. See, God looks for righteousness. In Israel, there wasn't any. It's just, instead of justice, we had bloodshed. Instead of righteousness, we had a cry of distress. When we were in Russia in 1994, when we were in St. Petersburg, we were staying at this apartment, flats, they speak British English. And so we stay in this flat. And do you remember the signs that were posted on the door that, just keep out? There's all kinds of signs there. And we actually had a bodyguard with us, Sergei, to protect us because St. Petersburg was so unsafe. There was a certain section when we walked from John Dowdy's house to the subway station, the metro. We couldn't say anything because it was an area totally controlled by the mafia. And if they heard us speaking, they know that we were not Russians, and therefore they would actually follow us and rob us. And so Matt and Charlie and I look enough Russian. See, that's one of the advantages of going to Russia. We at least look Russian. We go to Philippines or Ghana, we just don't look like those guys. See? But in Russia, see, we could get away with it if long we didn't say anything. See, you have the total breakdown of law and order in those places. There was a guy by the name of Andre when I was there in March, and he was a guy that operating inside the Optovsky Hotel, and he was a money changer. That is, he'd exchange euros or Swiss francs or dollars or for whatever for Belarusian rubles. And he had to pay the Russian mafia the equivalent of $25 a month, which is a lot of money for them, for the space that he operated inside the Optovsky Hotel. Every guy that had a little kiosk selling radiators or fan belts had to pay for protection, see, along the streets. If you wanted to sell Snickers candy bars or American whiskey, you had to pay for protection. See, that's is totally broke down. Totally broke down. That's how it is in a lot of those countries. You have to try to appreciate the hand of God and the genius of the founding fathers of this country, how they set it up so that there is, and has been some semblance of justice and there has been some semblance of righteousness. Makes a big difference on how well you function, whether or not you have comparative freedom. Thoughts or comments here so far? Well, going on then in Isaiah chapter 5, he said, "Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land." One of the things that God did when he set up Israel, he set it up. He said, "Now look at the land is mine." He said, "Now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to parcel it out. Each of the tribes gets their sector. And inside the tribe, each clan gets their sector. Inside the clan, each family gets their sector." And he said, "We're going to lay it out, and you're going to lay out the boundaries." One of the abominations that you would commit is if you move the ancient boundary, according to Proverbs, because the land was God's. And so part of it was, if a man died, he had no children, and then his brother, his next of kin, was to marry his wife and raise up children to the brother's name so that the property would stay in the family. Okay. So God said, the land is mine, and he set it up with those provisions so that the property retained. If somebody went into debt and had to sell their property, they really didn't sell the property, but God said, look at what you're selling is actually a number of crops. Because on the year of Jubilee, on the 50th year, all the property will revert back to the original family. God said, look, you're not really buying the land. He said, you're only buying a number of crops. So if it's the 33rd year, you're going to buy 17 crops. So that's what you do, see. So God had provisions to keep this from happening here. In every society, there are those who figure out how to work the economic system and how to work people in order to, you know, acquire most everything. That's why the tendency in every society is for the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer. The rich know how to do that. If you ever seen the Beetle Bailey comic strip, there's one of the characters in Beetle Bailey, you know, in the army, is a guy named Cosmo. And periodically you'll see a little Cosmo's corner. You know, he's got his shades on, and you know, he's got a little gambling operation and cards, and you know, anything you basically want you can get at Cosmo's corner. See, now the reason that that shows up in something like Beetle Bailey is that it's what happens in the army. You always got some guy over there knowing how to figure out how to get a few bucks out of all the other guys and run his business on the side, something like that. Let's see. Drugs and cigarettes are illegal in Montana state prisons. You think you can get drugs and cigarettes inside the prison? Mm-hmm. How can that be? That's how it works. Somebody knows how to work this system. I was talking to one of the guys that was in the state side of the prison in Great Falls, and he said, "You think about it." He said, "You got a guy here, he's a guard, he's working for the sheriff's, the county sheriff's department, and he's making maybe $10 an hour. His goal is to come in, have a smooth shift, drink some coffee, get out and go home and not think about it." So on the other side, you got another guy who's a human being, and just as intelligent than the guy that's patrolling the floors, and he's thinking 24 hours a day on how to beat the system. And he said, "Who do you think's going to win?" See, you got to. Do you think passing more laws solves anything? Well, there ought to be a law. You know, do you think because there's a law? It doesn't work that way. You just got to understand human nature. But on a larger scale, see, then you got these guys who know how to add house to house and land to land, and step by step take over. That's what happened in Western Europe. See, at some point, there's nobody, the common guy can't get any land. See, it's all locked up in these inheritances. And in one way or another, the people end up as serfs. So when the New World opened up, see, that was one of the great and tremendous blessings, is you had all this land. And so people could get out there and they could be free because they could actually own the property and work the property and do something. But what do you suppose happens again? House to house, land to land. Now, one of the most dangerous things that's going on right now is the conservation easements. Let's see, whether they're taking and setting 900 acres or 1,200 acres aside that can never use for development. What that is, now the guys generally who set that aside don't know what they're doing. But what that is, it's part of the Wildlands Project that a guy named David Foreman and a couple other guys worked together to eventually set up wildlife corridors so that wildlife can run untrammeled. Now, unless you think that's a small issue, there's already a grant of $75,000 to study the feasibility of a wildlife corridor over the Bozeman Pass. That's what it's called, wildlife corridor. And so the conservation easement, what's happened is that land is actually going to be turned over to the federal government at some point. So what's happening? See, who do you think the biggest property owner in the state of Montana is? See, 35% of Montana is federal property. And It's not that far from, see, King John and his deer. You know, and he owned all the deer in Sherwood Forest, and so if you shot one of the deer, you shot one of the king's deer. And the sheriff of Nottingham was the enforcement agency. See, these are just variation off of these themes. See, that's how they do it: land to land, house to house. That's what's happened in Israel. The result was the common guy was getting squished. He was getting crushed underneath that. And he had no recourse because there was no justice. there's no righteousness. He was stuck. Dan?
The federal government's not supposed to own any property outside of D.C., right?
Yeah, in military bases.
On military bases. Yeah. Okay, so the national forests and all that's unconstitutional?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, all you got to do is read your constitution. It'll tell you. See, they just took it in 1908 when they created the Forest Service and the BLM, Bureau of Land Management. They just took any property that wasn't homesteading. And now you can't get it unless you can file a claim that you can, patent for mineral rights. Otherwise, you can't get it. But, I mean, more to be said on that. The point is, see, there's nothing new in history here. This is what's happened. In verse 9 of Isaiah chapter 5, he said, "In my ears then the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will only yield one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain." Okay, it's getting about 1/10 back for what you sow. That was God's promise. See, when a society collapses, that's what happens. And you can go back. It's really interesting to me. Okay, all the ancient civilizations. Okay, Mesopotamia. What's that today? Desert. I mean, ask Jason. I mean, a lot of really fine, fertile farmland there, huh? Desert. It used to be fertile farmland. Okay. What happened to Egypt? All of North Africa. Okay. What happened to the great civilizations of South America? In Peru, Chile. Where are they today? Desert. It's really interesting if you check on it. Maybe there's a lesson there. But when a society collapses, then starvation is one of the first things that happens because the infrastructure for food is gone. So he's telling them, he said, this is what's going to happen in Israel. And he did. He said, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may flame them. And their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. They do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands." Butte's an interesting place to me. If you walk in a convenience store in Butte, not only do they have all the beer in the cases around the outside edge, but they'll just actually stack up rows of beer on the floor in the convenience store. And you actually have to walk around the beer, to try to find. It's really hard to find, water to buy. With a little tiny section for water. And you just see the people hauling the beer out of there. Usually when I'm there, it's afternoon and evening, and they're just hauling that beer out of there, buying it case after case after case of that stuff. Now, of course, I had the opportunity to buy gas in Great Falls. I had the opportunity to buy gas in East Helena. In Helena, I had the opportunity to buy gas in Bozeman. What do you think I see? Same thing. You watch people getting off work, and they're buying a few things to eat and, buying their booze. You don't think booze is a problem? Just check the police reports. Yeah. just check the traffic deaths. You don't think booze is a problem. I don't understand how a Christian can ever take a drink. It makes absolutely no sense to me that a person would be so weak that he would take a drink and thus encourage other people to continue to sink to the levels that they sink. Nasty stuff. What about these guys that are rise up early in the morning to pursue strong drink. What about the guys hauling that cube of beer home at night and cranking up TV, you know, Monday night football, Thursday night football, college football, you know, whatever else is on, you know, Jay Leno, David Letterman, yeah, I don't know who. Little entertainment, right? Case of beer and a little entertainment. A little lyre, a little harp, a little tambourine. I wonder if there's anything new under the sun. Don't pay attention to the deeds of the Lord. Don't even consider the work of His hands. Even think about it. Verse 13. Powerful, powerful verse. Therefore, my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge. And their honorable men are famished, and the multitude is parched with thirst. You know why? You know why a nation goes into slavery? Ignorance. Willful ignorance. Apathy. Like one guy was standing there talking to the other. He said, you know what's wrong with this country? He said, ignorance and apathy. The other guy said, you know, I don't know and I don't really care. Well, yeah. The people go into slavery because they're ignorant. No, no. A guy by the name of Paul Vitz was part of the President Reagan's Department of Education. And he actually resigned and did a major study. And he showed that references to the Bible and Christianity were systematically removed in all social studies textbooks used in the public schools at all levels. And especially any references to Christianity or the Bible from the years 1900 on. Now, that's programmed ignorance. That's a deliberate attempt to produce an ignorant people. See, anytime you get a government education system, you get a system that's going to teach what the government once taught. And a government education wants to produce a people that have enough education to be able to perform certain basic skills. But they don't want them to have enough education to where they really think about things. Say you're in China right now, and you go to the internet, and you want to do some research on, say, Taiwan, for example. What's going to happen? You're going to get blocked. If you get an email from a guy named Parveen Singh, who married a Chinese gal, teaching English in the Jingzhou, or however they pronounce it, used to be called Canton. He can't ever use any references to God or prayer in his email. He might occasionally do G blank D or something to say Heavenly Father or something like that, but he can never say God because those emails are being censored. In the digital realm, there are no secrets. If you think that you're sitting there in the privacy of your computer, do you realize that every digital transmission in the world is being monitored out of New Jersey? Every digital transmission. That includes cell phone calls. Did you know that your cell texts are a matter of permanent record? Every cell text you send or receive is a matter of permanent record. If they want it, they can go back and get it. Welcome to the digital age. See, See, programmed ignorance. That's the goal of people who want to make other people their slaves. They're very good at it. Brian. Now, here's a guy that's been called ignorant and in print here quite a bit lately, so I'm very interested to hear what he's got to say.
Actually, I have two comments. It would be a mistake to go back and read of the accounts in the Old Testament where God judges various nations and make the statement, well, that was under the Old Covenant, and he doesn't judge nations anymore, particularly when those nations were outside of the law of Moses anyway. So we would conclude that God's still in the business, so to speak, of judging a nation. And, you know, maybe doing the same thing today as far as nations that reject God will be wiped out and sold into slavery. So it's a mistake to do that, to assume that that would be an Old Testament phenomenon. And one other thing, too, is what I want to comment on, is not only is it that people don't know, they're programmed not to care. And I'm amazed personally at how difficult it is to get anybody to engage in anything important at all. It's very difficult in my experience. People you work with or people that you just meet, they don't really want to talk about anything of any substance.
Yeah. Trouble with truth requires action. And action really interferes with that case of beer and the lyre and the tambourine at night. By the way, Brian written a good letter to the editor on intelligent design and so forth, and you know, and he's being attacked for making ignorant statements. And you know, the guy today spoke of bloviating, and I really want to write back about, wow, what an example of bloviating, you know. But it has to do with hot air, by the way. But you see, it's a deliberate programmed ignorance, and it's a deliberate desire to remain ignorant. When people have a sense that things aren't right and they don't want to do anything about it, then the only route they can go is ignorant. If I don't, I mean, that's where the saying ignorance is bliss comes from. The only way I can maintain my blissful state is to be ignorant. So, it has several aspects to it. Tom.
What has been taking place over the last number of years on both the right and the left has been, instead of arguing the issues, it's character assassinations. You know, calling Brian's comments ignorant is basically calling Brian ignorant. And so what they're doing is they're attacking his character. And you see that taking place and all across the spectrum of the political scale. And it's really sad to see, because then you can't discuss the issues.
Yeah. And, you know, and let's face it, you know, what's called the right is actually the neoconservatives who are, you know, basically Trotskyites anyway. So, I mean,
people don't always make the connection between government education or public education and totalitarianism. In order to establish a one-world government or socialism where the government controls everything, you've got to destroy personal property rights. In order to destroy personal property rights, you've got to gradually condition people to accept the destruction of personal property rights through the coercive power of the government one way or another. In order to do that, you've got to destroy the public's confidence or even knowledge of what the Bible teaches regarding personal property rights. And so from the inception, the elitists of public education adopting from George Frederick Hegel, his philosophy was pantheism. So there was no God. Everything was God. And then when evolution came along, they dumped pantheism, kept the same system of socialism, and the government school system being the vehicle for utopia on Earth. And so the system from its inception in the early 1800s was socialistic in nature. So all they had to do was gradually eliminate the Bible, move socialists, atheists, into positions of leadership in the government school system, and then in due time through collective bargaining unify the teachers. So now you have the world's largest, potent, powerful political bloc in the NEA, which is totally socialistic. So people got to make that connection between socialism and the government school system through destroying personal property rights.
Yeah, woe to those who had land to hand, land and house to house. See, we're being subtly taught that the government's the solution to everything. Okay, how about insurance for children? You know, is that a latest issue? Okay. And what's the solution? We've got to have more government. See, no matter what, we've got to have more government. That, another name for that, socialism. So the people are ignorant, actually ignorant, what's going on. So in verse 14, he said, "Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure." Whew. This is the ugly side of death, boys. This is what happens after people die. Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the common man will be humbled, the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and the strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. You know, specifically, eventually talks about the coming of the church, which is always pictured as a place of peace inside the church itself. Now, never pictured as a place of peace outside the church. You know, outside the church, the world continues to be pictured as a place of violence and a place of injustice and a place of destruction. See? So, but God has made it pretty plain that those who persist in doing things their way, they will descend into Sheol. And the eternal darkness, then step by step, will overtake them. Rain?
Yeah, me and the girls are reading the Old Testament right now. We're in Numbers. And through reading the Old Testament, there doesn't appear to be any indication of those who were enslaved in Egypt to want to come out of Egypt to begin with. God wanted to bring them out, and he used Moses to actually do it. And there is a strong correlation exactly to, you know, like what Brian was saying today, is our motivation in bringing the message of the gospel forward to people is doing what essentially Moses did, and that was bringing something that he didn't really realize the magnitude of what he was doing or what was at hand, but he did come to realize that, and so we are too, is that, you know, God's using us to call people out of a darkness that they don't even really know exists. So it's going to be hard to build in them a desire until they actually see what they're about to lose. So, and they'll still, even under a little pressure, they'll still want to go back to Egypt.
Yeah, the leeks and onions and the garlics tasted pretty good. And, you know, you could just sit there and at your treadle and treadle water out of the Nile and irrigate your crops, you know. And that's, you know, secure, peace and security. That's what it is. You want earthly peace and security. You're sitting duck for this. So God was going to be exalted in judgment. We'll come back to this. He said, "Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as with cart ropes." Can anybody say Hollywood? Okay. "Who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One draw near and come to pass that we may know it." Hey, there's no God. Jesus Christ is a fairy tale. You know, come on. You know, the stuff on the second coming. Cut a tiny bit of Sean Hannity yesterday or day before or sometime, and he was talking about somebody who said that Jesus' second coming was going to occur within 3 years, and that was 2 years ago. And they were kind of laughing about that. Of course, you know, the guys that are premillennialists are stupid anyway, and these guys that make these big statements that, you know, Jesus is going to come. Jesus plainly said, nobody knows the day or the hour he's coming. How is somebody going to stand up and say he's coming? You know, such and such a time. That's, you just can't get any more stupid than that. Jesus said, you don't know. Say, we know. Okay? I don't know what else to call that. I don't know. But God is pretty plain here that he is going to execute. Verse 20 said, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light, light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet, sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right." There you are, justice. "Therefore, as the tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out." Okay. If there's anybody in there that'll repent, see, God would rescue them. But if the people persist, then he's got more. "He'll also lift up the standard to a distant nation and whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps, nor is the belt of its waist undone. Nor is its sandal strap broken. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The horses of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like a young lion. It growls as it seizes its prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there's darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by the clouds." Would it be possible for some nation to overtake the United States? Could God do it? Yeah. You know, the princes of Egypt, he said, you know, they're blind. They get bad counsel. See, and consequently, they fall apart at the approach of Babylon. See, over and over again, God says that he can do this. He can bring somebody from somewhere and destroy that which is which he wants to execute justice. And he can do it again if he chooses to do so.
But that will only happen when the country becomes so degenerate and so weak within itself that it'll fall like a rotten apple. Yep. And it's taken place.
Yep. The rod is at work. Make it quick, John.
But if this country is going to be, well, like all countries, at some point judged because of its descent into immorality, that's why it's even more critical that we understand we're separate. Mm-hmm. And the pursuit of separation is the pursuit of information. Yeah. And the pursuit of truth. Mm-hmm. You know, so educating ourselves is that much more critical, and then also spreading that education to other people.
Exactly right. Almost what I was going to say. Perfect. See, what is the solution? Well, it's for us is to become educated. When Jesus said, "You go, you make disciples, you immerse those disciples, and you teach those disciples to observe all that I commanded," that is a great set of instructions. And so God wants education. One of the reasons that we're going to do this series is so that you have an idea about the ebb and flow of history, and you actually see some of the documentation. Most of it you're familiar with because we've had the opportunity to bring it up one way or another. You know, we've talked about the Middle Ages. You know, we've talked about the Renaissance. We've talked about the Reformation. We talked about the things that set up the formation of the United States. But you're going to see some documentation here in visual form. So it'll give you an idea as to the ebb and flow of history and give you a better idea of where we're at right now and the necessity then of attacking this thing with information. Not being upset if you get somebody like Brian was talking about that doesn't want to listen. Just keep moving. Just keep moving, because there are people out there who do want to listen. There are people whose life circumstances has opened them up to think about things. You don't know who's sitting there contemplating things underneath the surface. And so just keep moving. Just keep those conversations going. Just keep talking to people. Sooner or later, you're going to stumble into somebody who is interested. and who wants to engage. I don't know if you're going to have to move through 50 people. It's kind of interesting. Sometimes you move through two, and the third person you hit, he's interested. Sometimes you can move through 200 and not have a single one. I mean, I've had it both ways. And but it's okay. It doesn't matter. If you can just find one that's interested, engage in discussion, then praise the Lord for that. See, the bottom line is here, at some point, God is going to come. Jesus is going to come back, and he's going to execute judgment upon this earth. We want to be the kind of people who are ready for that day, regardless of what we have to go through to get there. And we want to be able to find anybody else that's interested in order that they can successfully go through that judgment. That's what God is really reaching for.